is the hearing that we're going to be addressed is one of the first ones that was set back after we began dealing with shutdown issues. This goes back to March 25th. Let me first introduce the panel of the Court of Appeals today. Myself, Renee Werke, will be presiding. Judge Lucinda Jessen and Judge Heidi Shellhaus are joining us. Today is May 27th, 2020, and we're beginning our WebEx hearings for today's date. The first hearing that is set for argument is file A190905, Julia Hynek, now Julia Kamer, versus Eric Hynek. And I believe both attorneys are there. I just want to make sure that you can hear us audibly. Is that correct? Appellate's attorney?
Yes, Your Honor.
And respondent attorney?
Jana, you're on mute.
I can see Ms. Deitch present. Can you hear me speak?
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now.
Okay, thank you.
With that said, even though we are doing this via WebEx, the rules of appellate procedure continue to apply. Each of you will have 15 minutes to argue in favor of your client. There's an additional 5 minutes that will be reserved for rebuttal to appellant's counsel if you choose to utilize that function. The judges are ready to go. We do have our marshal who is going to be keeping time. There will be a timer on the screen. And hopefully if you don't see it, please let me know. I will remind you if you do run over time. And with that said, we'll turn to appellant counsel. Please introduce yourself and indicate which party you're speaking on behalf of before you begin your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, my name is Kevin Sandstrom, and I am appearing on behalf of the appellant, Eric Hynek. And this is a very important, critical case for my client. He's basically distraught and devastated by the district court's actions in this case, which have essentially destroyed his parent-child relationship with both of his children and his parental rights, essentially eliminated now for ongoing 2 years. And these children were his life. He loved them dearly. They had a very strong parental bond. And now that's been destroyed. And frankly, we believe the district court's actions in this case are quite extreme and outrageous. And my client has really lost faith in the court system to do what's right to maintain his family. And, you know, it's really, I think at this point, up to this Court of Appeals panel of three judges to undo what the district court has done and reinstall some level of faith on the part of my client in the court system that he can have a parent-child relationship with his children.
Mr. Sandstrom, I have my first question for you on behalf of the panel. What is it that you actually want the Court of Appeals to do? I mean, obviously this is family law based. It's got a 9-year history as far as modification of parenting time. The record is replete with determinations of credibility as well as conduct by the judge. What is it that you feel that we are empowered to do when we have this district court order in front of us?
Well, we absolutely believe this court should reestablish the custody and parenting time schedule that existed in the party's original divorce decree. This entire occurrence and series of conduct, I think, is intended by the district court to be a temporary order, albeit at this point it's been ongoing for 2 years, a very protracted period of time. My understanding and my belief, even to this day, is that this district court order was intended to be temporary and that this court would have all the power to determine that that temporary order was improper and reinstate the prior order, which was a 50-50 custody schedule.
So, Mr. Sandstrom, that was one of my questions for you. I mean, because you're saying, well, there wasn't an evidentiary hearing for the suspension, there wasn't a prima facie case, but the district court's May 2019 order said that any party could bring a motion to relief for your client's parenting time. Why didn't you do that?
Well, you know, frankly, I think my client had fought through at least a half a dozen different hearings, motions, submissions to the court over the course of over a year at that point. If the court will recall, this all stemmed back to May of 2018, and really the initial motion brought by the respondent filed March, or sorry, not May, March 27th of 2018. And over the course of that entire year, stemming through May of 2019, you can see in this record time and time and time again, my client returning back to district court, just beseeching the court to undo what it had did and reinstate some level of parental rights to my client, and just it falling on deaf ears. And so we see that final order of the court is really just a hollow statement by the court, having my client having fought through so many different motion hearings, the end result of that process being, well, file another motion and maybe I'll reconsider it this time. After having filed half a dozen different motions to try to get a guardian ad litem appointed, get some sort of in-camera review of the poor children's viewpoint on these issues.
Mr. Sandstrom, this is Judge Schellhaus. If I can interrupt just for a moment.
Absolutely.
The January 2019 order indicated that your client's parenting time would be suspended until the children's therapist indicated that he should have contact with them. I'm a little confused. Are those the therapists in Minnesota, or are they therapists in Utah?
You know, your guess is as good as mine. I think my understanding is it's the therapists in Minnesota who had begun seeing the children again as of their return, which was in the spring of 2019. And so I think the court's intention would have been as of May of 2019 that they are seeing therapists again in Minnesota, and those would be the persons with some input as to when parental rights might be reestablished. But again, I find this to be quite outside the realm of what's reasonable and rational when it's just left to the whim of therapists. When my client at this point,
okay, let me just ask you this. So what I think I hear you saying is that the children have been back in Minnesota since the spring of 2019?
Correct. They were gone for roughly 10 months. So a very long period of time in the detention facility in Utah, but that's okay. late April of 2018 through 10 months. I know it's 10 months, and now I'm forgetting the exact date that they were returned to Minnesota, spring of 2019.
Okay. I personally have some concerns about their placement in Utah, but that really is water over the dam now. So they've been back in Minnesota since 2019. Has your client had any contact with the children's therapists since their return?
No, he hasn't had contact with the therapists or the children, to my knowledge. I mean, we're really just left in limbo here. You know, the irony here is...
What has he done besides appeal? Has he gotten any therapy himself consistent with prior orders that he do so?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think there's anything in the record indicating he's had any additional therapy in it, so I'm not sure that's anything this court can consider as to what's happened since the appeal has been filed. It's really a matter of these kids had so much therapy, in realizing that the final order issued by the court comes 14 months after this whole debacle arises. That's 14 months worth of no contact with my client and intensive therapy with therapists in Utah, in Minnesota, to try to reprogram them to have a relationship with their mother. Okay, my client is left sitting on the sidelines saying, tell me when I can see my children again. And these kids at the point of the court's final order have already had 14 months away from their father.
Mr. Sandstrom, if I could follow up on Judge Schellhaus's question about the Utah issue. Sure. So it seems to me that part of that is, where was the child? Was that a change in residency, right? And I guess, you know, I think the respondent's arguing, well, it's really the residency of the mother that counts. I assume you think, and I'm looking at the statute, it's really the children's residency. But then what do we look at to define residency? Could you help us with that?
Well, certainly, I think it's where the children are living. I think it's a fallacy for the respondent to say she can ship the children to Utah or China or anywhere else in the world and say, well, the residence is still Minnesota because that's where I live and I'm a custodian, yet the children are in a boarding school against their will in a different state. I just don't find it at all appropriate. And again, my client repeatedly raised his concerns about that issue to the district court and it just fell on deaf ears.
But help us, because we need to say, well, was the statute followed if it is the children's residence that was involved? And then, well, how do we define residency? I think it was the respondent talked about 518.003 subdivision 9, I believe it was, talking about a permanent home. Do you agree that's the definition we should be using? Is there some other definition you would point us to?
Well,
and also, is any of this as far as how long they were there in the record? Because I can see how that might be important in looking at residency, but, you know, and there's a lot in the record here. I just didn't find the place where it says, and they were in Utah for X many months.
And I apologize. I don't have that reference off the top of my head as to an item in the record. I certainly know that as of the time of, it's clear in the evidentiary hearing in September, they are still in Utah, and that's 4 or 5 months after they had been brought to Utah that they are still there. And so we know even as of the evidentiary hearing, they've been gone for a protracted period, and there's even at that point in the testimony, no date certain by which they would be returning to Minnesota. I mean, I look at statute 518.18 regarding modifications of custody orders, subpart D and small Roman numeral 5 talks about moving the residence of the child to another state. And it talks about, you know, there's some sort of presumption or assumption in the statute that the custodial parent is going to be moving with the children. That wasn't the case here, but certainly the residence of the child is the critical issue, not the residence of the parent. I mean, there's some assumption on the part of the legislator that parent and child go together. And the bizarre fact scenario here is children are shipped against their will.
So is there anything in the record that we could rely upon to that would demonstrate that the children were in Utah longer than 4 or 5 months?
I apologize. I don't have anything that's pinpointing in the record right at this moment. This record is obviously quite extensive, and I just don't have a citation to a document off the top of my head to establish that for you. So I mean, that's certainly a major concern, and I understand there's some concern on the part of the court that's kind of water over the dam at this point, but there's numerous other issues with this case. First and foremost, what come to my mind are the complete elimination of my client's parenting time rights, which I think there's numerous case law, such as the Young versus Young case, saying this is a very severe sanction, not to be taken lightly when someone's parental visitation rights are completely eliminated. And that's just thrown out the window by this court's order, and we believe on very scant evidence. I mean, the biggest stumbling block here seemed to be, you know, the special master ordering my client to participate in therapy and engage in certain activities in therapy, and not feeling like my client did enough. And, you know, notwithstanding the fact he had an awesome relationship with his kids, these kids were well-adjusted, doing great in school, and very clearly preferred their father, none of that apparently matters here. All that matters is my client didn't do enough in therapy, therefore his parental rights should be terminated. That's just outrageous. It flies in the face of any level of discretion. We think it's a clear abuse of discretion on the part of the district court, and can't be tolerated. It just cannot be tolerated at all. The other thing here that really sticks in my and my client's craw is the fact that these kids had such a clear preference. They're older teenage kids, particularly the son, who's 16 at the time of the evidentiary hearing. The court just brushes that preference aside, saying that, you know, this is some product of manipulation by the father, so I'm not even going to consider it. And I think the Court of Appeals here has the ability to review that issue de novo, given that there was no real credibility determination because the court didn't actually hear any evidence from these children. The court made a blanket decision that it was not going to hear from the children, that their viewpoint was inherently not credible. And I think that's
In this case, wasn't it the court appointed expert that did talk to the children and the court relied upon that? I mean, or maybe it was a special master. You can help me figure out which, or was it both?
Well, if you read the testimony from Dr. Volchik, I don't think he ever said that these children can't be trusted at all, or their opinions are completely unreliable or inherently unreliable. And the reality being, for children in these older children in these sort of circumstances, the case law is also clear that even in the face of some level of claimed manipulation or influence on the part of the favored parent, you still should give some credibility, preference, weight to those children's preference, because nothing good can come of sending a teenage child against their will to live with a parent that they don't want to be with. That's exactly what the Ross v. Ross case talks about, where it says that the teenage child's preference should be given overwhelming consideration. And where did that happen in this case?
Mr. Sandstrom, I need to remind you, which I'm sure you don't know, but I was the attorney that did not prevail in Ross versus Ross. Well, that dates me. I know that.
And I think some of the statements of law in Ross are important in terms of the level of credibility determination, or at least some ability to provide a preference on the part of the children that was just completely ignored here. You know, the request for a guardian ad litem as well was really an effort to give these children some voice, and that was just thrown out the window as well. And I apologize. Right. I think I'm out of time here by both my own timer and the court's. And so I'll hand over the...
You'll have your 5 minutes for rebuttal. We'll turn now to respondent counsel.
Judge Werke, this is Judge Shulhas. For some reason, I cannot see Ms. Deitch. Maybe I'll be able to hear her, but she dropped off my screen.
Ms. Deitch, I can see you.
Judge Shulhas, can you?
I can hear you. Oh, now I can see you. Okay. Right. Sorry about that interruption.
And please introduce yourself and your client before you begin, Ms. Deitch.
Yes. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jana Oney Deitch, and I represent the respondent, Julia Kemmer, in this appellate proceeding.
All right. We left off with appellate counsel, with Mr. Sandstrom. He brought up the guardian ad litem provision, and I think that's what bothers me about this case is, you know, we're not looking at a permissive appointment, but a required appointment, and we review the court's determination under an abuse of discretion. What's the best argument you have for us looking at this and not determining that all of the behavioral conduct that has went on does not arise to some type of abuse of these children?
Certainly, Your Honor. Well, the basis for the appellant's motion for the guardian ad litem was the allegations made against my client, the respondent, in terms of the children's statements that their mother had been abusing them. However, the district court found that there was insufficient evidence of child abuse or neglect as alleged by the appellant to support a mandatory appointment of the guardian ad litem. And I do want to point to a statement that Dr. Wojcik made, who was the court-appointed expert in this case, who testified at the evidentiary hearing that the children were afraid their father would be agitated if they did not describe to him that their mother was unkind, hostile, abusive. And so there was kind of lead into the other argument made by the appellant in terms of not interviewing the children. The children's statements were not credible. They could not be relied upon. Both the special master, Stephen Schmidt, and Dr. Wojcik made findings that the children were so aligned with the appellant that they subscribed to his reality that mother was all bad and father was perfect. And so the district court, in its order, stated that the children's preferences could not be reliable because of the coaching that was being done by father in this case. And therefore, the district court believed it did, number one, didn't have enough evidence to support a mandatory appointment of a guardian ad litem. And secondly, chose not to interview the children because of that alignment with father, and that what their statements might have been to the court were not going to be reliable.
Ms. Ditch, it troubles me that when we're dealing with a 16-year-old, and I think at the time 13 or 14-year-old, that the court would delegate its duty to make credibility determinations about children that old and simply accept the determinations made by professionals or a special master, especially when there was no guardian ad litem appointed in this case. Those are the two things that trouble me the most about this case, is that the court who could have spoken with the children and decided that they weren't credible, refused to even give these children a voice. Had they been in juvenile court, they would have been appointed attorneys and guardian ad litems. I want you to address that some more, because I'm really concerned about the fact that these kids seem to have had no voice in this case.
Certainly, Your Honor. Well, I will point out that interviewing the children is only one of the 12 factors that the court considers when looking at a modification of custody. And no one factor takes priority over the others. The children had been interviewed by the special master, and the district court did have a record of that interview. The children had been seen by therapists. And I think what's really important and telling is that when the children were able to get to Diamond Ranch Academy, which is a therapeutic boarding school, the appellant loves to use provocative language such as a detention facility or a juvenile facility, and it was not that. It was a therapeutic boarding school.
Well, excuse me, wasn't it a residential treatment facility?
It was a residential treatment facility that was also a school. So it was a place where children who needed intensive therapy could go and continue to get their education.
And what professional in the case decided that these children needed residential treatment?
Well, the therapist, the problem I think that we had, Your Honor, was that the appellant was interfering with the children's therapy in Minnesota. It wasn't moving forward. It wasn't happening. Then we had the incident where appellant refused to return the children back to mother in violation of the district court's very direct order. As a result of that, the Washington County Sheriff's Department had to go into father's home and remove the children. Because they were refusing to go to mother's home, they had already run away twice. Mother had very serious concerns that if they came to her home, they'd run away again. Then, you know, their physical safety would be in danger. And so they were placed temporarily in foster care. And she made the decision that they needed the intensive therapy. She tried to find a place in Minnesota, but the waiting list was too long. And the only place she could find that was going to be able to meet both the therapeutic needs, the educational needs of the children, was Diamond Ranch Academy in Utah. And it was successful. Once the children could get away from father and his pressure on them to subscribe to his views regarding mother and interfere with that relationship between mother and the children had quite the epiphany in terms of what had been happening. And that all came through in the testimony of Dr. Wojcik at the evidentiary hearing, in that they had really come to understand what had been happening with their father and this feeling that they had to say these things about their mother to make him feel better. And they were finally coming to terms that they could love both their parents, contrary to what their prior views had been. So there was no designated therapist that said these children needed, but it was really the only recourse that respondent had to place the children in a safe place where they could get the therapeutic help that they needed.
Counsel, could you help me with a somewhat unrelated issue? And that is the appellant's argument that there was not an evidentiary hearing before the suspension of his parental rights. And I think he's assuming that's kind of the April suspension. And as I look at the record, it was a hearing, but there wasn't an evidentiary hearing. There wasn't an evidentiary hearing until September. Am I tracking factually?
That is correct, Your Honor. Your timeline is correct.
So did anyone ask for an evidentiary hearing? Was this raised below? Because I don't recall either of you addressing that in your briefs.
So I will, I guess, backtrack to my client's motion to modify custody and restrict appellant's parenting time was the motion from March 26th or 27th of 2018. Then we had the April 2nd hearing in which the court verbally ordered from the bench that he was granting my client's request, and he scheduled that date the evidentiary hearing for September 14th of 2018. So yes, I believe in both parties' motion pleadings, there was a request for an evidentiary hearing, which the court then granted.
So from your perspective, it's that 4 months later hearing was the evidence. So by that point, his parenting time had been suspended for 4 months.
Well, I will go back to the April 2nd, 2018 order. My client had asked for a full suspension of parenting time, but Judge Meslow didn't do that. He still granted the appellant some parenting time. However, because appellant continued in his pattern of violating court orders, not doing as the court had directed, it ultimately then later came to be a full suspension of his parenting time. He was ordered not to contact the children outside of his parenting time, which he did. He was ordered, this has been going on for several months, even prior to that, not going to, he was not allowed to go to the children's like activities or sports or be on the school grounds. He did that again. So as a result of appellant's own conduct, the consequence was the district court had to fully suspend his parenting time because he would never comply with the court's direct orders in terms of how and when he could have contact with the children.
Well, we're talking about a constitutional right here to have a relationship with your children. Why couldn't father have had visiting rights with his children in a supervised setting?
He could have, and I think the effort had been going on for so long to work with the appellant and the children to get to the place where he could, as he was ordered to by both Judge Ekstrom, the special master, and by Judge Meslow, number one, go to therapy himself to understand the role that he played in the children's basically rejection of mother, to support the children's own therapy and let them come to the conclusion that they could have a loving relationship with both parents and stop denigrating mother and damaging the relationship that the children had with her. Through all of those efforts, the only authority or consequence that the court could impose upon appellant was to reduce his parenting time to get him to comply with the numerous court orders and directions by both Judge Ekstrom, the special master, and others in terms of helping the children get back to a loving, healthy relationship, not just with mother, but with both parents. Could it have been in a supervised setting? I think the problem that we had once we got past April 2nd and we had the incident with the Washington County Sheriff's Department, who had to remove the children, is that there was nowhere for the children to go. It was a 30-day placement in foster care. And beyond that, either the children would need to go back to mother or they really would be put in a juvenile facility, which mother did not want to have happen. And so, unfortunately, the only recourse that she had if she was going to try to find help for these children was to put them in the therapeutic residential center in Diamond Ranch Academy. And so father's supervised parenting time didn't happen at that point. But as I want to point out, as one of the judges mentioned, as of even January of 2019, the court made it clear that they were waiting for the therapist to be able to make recommendations. And mother testified at the evidentiary hearing. She is not trying to keep father out of these children's lives. She wants the children to have a healthy relationship with him. But we needed the therapist to guide that. And, excuse me, in May of 2019, as I believe Judge Jessen pointed out, the court invited either parent to say, look, if you've got concerns about the parenting time, bring a motion. And father has not done that. I think to your point, Judge Shellhas, you know, he's done nothing other than appeal since May of 2019, even though he was given a clear green light from the court to bring a motion if he was not getting his parenting time. And we have had Dr. Wojcik, who's overseeing the therapy for these two children, who has been overseeing the therapy, and he has been writing reports to the court, and the attorneys have received those reports. So we are aware of the children's progress in therapy. Of course, with the COVID-19 issues, that's obviously slowed things down, but nothing has prevented father from bringing a motion to at least get more clarity on the therapy issue or when he can start to reinstate his parenting time.
If I may ask you the same question I asked Mr. Sandstrom, what does the record tell us was the length, the period of time that the children were in Utah? Because I must say it does concern me for children to be moved out of state for a lengthy period of time in these sorts of situations, with particularly without, you know, a court order.
My best count, Your Honor, is roughly 8 months. They went to Diamond Ranch Academy at the end of April, and I believe they were back in early winter of 2019.
Where does the record reflect that? Because that was what I was having a hard time finding, any part of the record that had them in Utah past the September evidentiary hearing.
Your Honor, I don't know that the record does state it specifically. I believe that my client did testify at the evidentiary hearing that it was her understanding or expectation that the children would be coming back to Minnesota in the early winter timeframe of 2019, and they were actually back by that time. So that's, I think, the best indication that I can give you of the record and how long the children were in Utah. I just want to point out, with my last few minutes remaining, that the district court, well, the other thing I want to point out is that appellant chose not to offer any trial exhibits or offer any witnesses at the September 14th evidentiary hearing. He did not object to the respondent's 18 trial exhibits going in, nor her witnesses. And I want to quote from the Court of Appeals in a prior case, where a party does not succeed on appeal, or that a party does not succeed on appeal by complaining about a district court's failure to rule in his favor. One of the reasons it did not do so is because that party failed to provide the evidence that would allow the district court to fully address the question. So here we have someone who chose not to present any evidence at the evidentiary hearing or give the district court any basis to rule in his favor or even hear his views. So the court had the evidence submitted by mother, which reflected many years of appellant's actions that endangered the children. There was numerous instances that were laid out both in her motion pleadings and the testimony at trial, which was supported by Dr. Wojcik, who testified that he believed that the children were being emotionally abused and psychologically abused by father through his actions in terms of all of the interference with therapy, the violations of the court orders, and the pressure on the children to align with him and reject mother. I see my time is up. Thank you.
Judge Working, may I ask one question?
Please go ahead. I had to unmute to answer. Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Ms. Deitch, I am not aware of any existing case law that suggests that a custodial parent, albeit one who has sole custody and legal custody, has the right to move a child out of state, whether that's for a month to the grandparents, 8 months to the grandparents, to an aunt, an uncle, a friend, or a residential treatment center. If this is the law, as you suggest it should be, isn't this a terrible precedent for future cases?
What I would say to answer your question is,
I'm talking, and I'm sorry, I mean without advance court approval, just self-help.
I guess I don't know the answer to whether it is a terrible precedent. Given the facts and the history of this case, it was, I believe, necessary for mother to take this action. She had been awarded sole legal custody of the children, so she could, and actually since 2015 at least, she had the sole decision-making authority over medical, dental, therapy, orthodontic for the children anyway. And it was really her only way to get the children the therapeutic help that they needed. And so I think on a case-by-case basis, the Court of Appeals will have to determine those instances. In this case, it was necessary and it was really the only option that my client had.
Thank you, Ms. Deitch. We'll go back now to appellant counsel. Mr. Sandstrom, you have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, first of all, I'd like to address the Diamond Ranch Academy issues here briefly and some of the comments that have been made. There's obviously a debate or dispute about whether it's a therapeutic facility or a detention facility. I will tell the court, I think you can take judicial notice, it promotes itself as a place for troubled teens. And it is, in fact, a place where kids with significant problems go.
And how can we take judicial notice of the caliber of an institution when we don't have record evidence? We don't have any testimony as far as what it is. We simply have your client's representation that it's a detention facility versus the mother of the children, her representation.
Well, I think you can look at just the website for the facility itself.
Says I mean, I hate to say this, but I think we'd be remiss if we didn't note that Dr. Drew and Dr. Phil are always using Diamond Ranch Academy, but we can't take judicial notice of things like that.
Sure. Well, I think my client's submissions to the court made it clear to the court that it was a detention facility that should have warranted greater scrutiny and questioning by the district court as to whether there really was a need for these well-adjusted children to be ripped out of school, ripped away from their friends, ripped away from both parents, to be sent to a facility in Utah. They didn't go willingly. They were directed there by their mother. And to say on the part of the mother that it was necessary, I find that disingenuous. I really do not understand what was necessary about it other than to punish the children for the fact that they didn't want to be with her and preferred to be with dad. She was concerned that they were going to try to flee her custody again. How telling is this that these children just simply can't stand to be with their mother to the extent that she feels the need to ship them to Utah to prevent them from seeing their own father. It's really just a sad state of affairs. It's depressing, frankly. And to say that that was necessary or that she had some latitude to do that is just beyond the pale. And, you know, the other thing that has been said here repeatedly in the briefs and in argument that my client was abusive. If you read Dr. Vojic's testimony, I don't think he calls my client abusive at all. I mean, he says the kids have kind of created this viewpoint on their own based upon just their interactions with dad and seeing dad get agitated. But there was no coaching by dad. There's zero evidence of coaching. There's zero evidence of him telling them to take these actions. I mean, I want the court to understand the event that kicked this all off was the children were riding in the car with their mother. The 15-year-old boy was driving. He and the daughter can't stand the mother so badly that they physically drive the car to dad's house, jump out of the car, and flee into dad's house to try to get away from mom. I mean, how is it then that it's so appropriate to terminate my client's parental rights and give sole custodial rights to the mother in this sort of scenario where teenage children are desperately trying to be with their father? And reminder, at that point, my client had already had his custody reduced to just every other weekend. It was not a 50-50 schedule as of March of 2018. The special master, more than a year earlier, had substantially reduced my client's visitation parental time rights to just every other weekend. That's less than 25% of the parenting time that had been in place for more than a year. The kids were just tired of being in their mother's custody at that point for a majority of the time and just desperately wanted to be with dad. That's their crime in this case. And that's my client's crime, is having a loving relationship with his children. And the sad reality being his punishment is to have his parental rights terminated for 2 years now. There's nothing more that he can do to go back to the district court. What is he supposed to submit to the court at this point? Hey, I hope the therapist will let me see my children at this point, but I have no idea what they're doing or what the children are doing because I can't even talk to my kids. You know, how is he supposed to change this circumstance? He's at the mercy of therapists and the respondent in this case and the therapists. There's nothing more he can do. He's stuck. He needs this court to assist him. He has no other remedies. That's all we can ask. That's my time. I'm happy to answer any follow-up final questions, but I've used up my time and I think I've gotten my points across.
Thank you to both attorneys for appearing via WebEx in support of your arguments and in arguing in support of your briefs. The matters are submitted in the way it has been in the past. You will receive an order from this court within the statutory timeframe. We have another hearing, but we're going to reconstitute the panel. So I will ask that the attorneys go ahead and leave this session. And Sue, if you're available, if you would put the judges in the lobby, please.